the very basic tools to understand at least the language of things that come out naturally when one is trying to implement things in a computer. You looked at some simple systems, and now we're going to begin to mix it up with higher level discussions, higher level techniques, and some still some basic questions and tasks for you to be able to do within the levels that you can absorb and come up with sufficient confidence during these 3 weeks. So we're now kind of going to have a mix of low or fundamental level questions or fundamental level discussions together with some kind of looking out there what is current in nowadays leading research. So Antti was asking me the other day if we were going to show some examples of current efforts in different problems, and indeed that was what we were planning to do both the first day of this week and the first day of next week. The first day of this week, it's all following the idea that this week we're going to be mainly talking about hydrodynamics or matter. Remember, by the end of last week, we wrote Einstein's equations. We said, well, we could work hard on the part that has a GAB, write it in terms of things that had a well-defined initial value problem, where if we know the state of the system, we could go forward in the future. But there was a TAV, the stress energy tensor, and then we said, okay, someone has to define what is the stress energy tensor that we want to work with in a particular situation, and understand what are the equations of motions that determine how that source will change. So for the case of fluids or hydrodynamics, matter, for the reasons that you'll hear later today and during the week, things have to be done with a quite delicate way because of the intrinsic things that happen with the fluid. Just so gravity, in some sense, is the easiest one of the fields. We know the gravitational potential in and around us is just a continuous function, even though we are standing on a huge discontinuity. If you calculate the density of the floor and the density of air, there's a huge difference there. And that's gravitational field is completely insensitive in that way. The gravitational field, as you go across the floor into the open air, is just continuous. But the matter that is describing it, in a sense, the difference between the floor and the air, is significantly discontinuous. Or there is a huge jump in between this one and air. And that's something that will come, and we're going to have to deal with it in an appropriate fashion. So part of a lot of the motivations for numerical relativity have to do with the reality that within this decade, very, very likely, I mean, you can make a decent bet, the gravitational waves will be measured for the first time directly within this decade. Of course, once the gravitational waves are detected, then you open up a whole new window to the universe. Instead of just looking at things with respect to electromagnetic fields that get to us and then we can capture them through different telescopes, we can also now use these other detectors to catch up gravitational waves, which are extremely different in their nature, and we're going to discuss a lot more about this next week. But then there is a possibility, there are a number of systems out there that will be able to radiate very strongly in gravitational waves and electromagnetic waves. And therefore, there is a promise that you can see exactly the same source with very different channels, and therefore you can go very, very deep into the source that is producing them. The three main systems for these are binary black holes, but binary black holes, if you consider them in complete vacuum, not doing anything, not interacting with anything else, that they, of course, give no gravitational electromagnetic radiation because the stress energy tensor is zero. There is nothing else but vacuum. On the other hand, black hole neutron stars and binary neutron star binaries, they involve a very strong curvature, a really highly dynamic process. But because you have matter involved in there, and maybe a lot more, you can have plenty of signals coming from a system. In addition also to electromagnetic waves, we can detect things coming from through neutrinos. So the system has many different channels to emit energy, and you like to understand them all, just because some of the most ill understood questions or systems in the universe out there are tremendously energetic, and we really have no much of a clue. Aside from perhaps some good intuition of what is going on at the core of them to try to understand them. And so a lot of effort is being put in nowadays to try to go in that direction. some problems may be solved in the short time, some problems may be with us for a long time. So this supernova core collapse problem, it might be there for quite a long time before we really understand what's going on. And of course, even if you say, well, I really don't care about gravity, like I'm studying something where the gravity is pretty much fixed, say, I'm sorry, a black hole that is accreting matter from its surrounding, you're going to have to deal with the curvature of the spacetime. And in that case, you're assuming gravity doesn't change, but the dynamical nature of the matter side of things could be quite interesting. And you'll see examples of that in just a few minutes. So when you try to study these systems, you want to, well, understand the behavior of the curvature, maybe, and also the behavior of matter, plasma, and everything else that is being part of this TAB stress energy tensor. Trying to do that accurately for these systems that I mentioned is a really tall order. You have to include, in addition to gravity, the behavior of matter, maybe magnetic fields, and a bunch of other things that will come into it. And so one tries to build up a ladder of ever more complicated, richer descriptions of the system. And depending on what you're able to do or what may capture the basics, the main features of a given system, you might scale down and not include everything that you know is playing a role, but just the leading contributions. And then therefore there are different approximations that are thrown in that can capture perhaps the main aspects of the system. And these are things that you discuss later in the week. But let me just give you some examples of systems where we know absolutely we're going to have to worry about it. If we really worry about them, if we really want to make out the most physics of a given system. So I'll just give you a couple of examples here first, and then Scott will talk about a few other ones. So one is, suppose you have a galaxy merger. So we know, or there is a good possibility, that galaxies have undergone several mergers in their history. We know that every galaxy that deserves its name nowadays has a black hole sitting in the middle. So eventually, if you have, say, two galaxies, and just this is kind of my very poor man's attempt to draw a galaxy, with their black holes in the middle, they come together. Eventually, they merge. If everything goes right, and then there is a big question mark there, but if everything goes right, eventually you're going to have these two black holes orbiting about each other and eventually merging into a single one. Something we'll also discuss next week is that gravitational radiation carry a few things, carry energy and angular momentum, but if you happen to send more energy in a particular direction than in another one, the final resulting black hole may be recoiling. So you have, just because the system is asymmetric, if you send an overall net energy momentum in that direction, since the center of mass in general relativity has to be conserved, then the final black hole has to move in the opposite direction to counterbalance this excess energy in a given direction. So you could very well end up with a situation where you have a circumbinary disk, a disk that was created from the initial disk that each black hole has. It's some distance away, and now you have a black hole that is moving in a given direction. It will take some time for the disk to realize that this black hole is moving, and when it does so, it will generate a very interesting dynamics there. Alternatively, or in addition, when the black holes are merging, there might be magnetic fields that are sourced by the disk, threading the region around the black holes, and this black hole might twist these fields in a particular way that it might induce radiation purely from the fact that these two black holes are distorting the space-time where this magnetic field is going through. So these are just some of the examples you can do. So this is, for instance, a work done by essentially next student of mine, Miguel Megavan, where he actually was thinking about the problem. Well, suppose you just formed the black hole. This black hole has a recoil, so it's moving in a particular direction, and you have some disk some distance away. How will the disk react to the fact that now, instead of having a black hole, if the black hole were to sit in the middle steadily, this disk would be essentially stationary. But when the black hole begins to move, now some interesting dynamics might happen, and then that's what the movie shows. This is the density at the equatorial plane, and all of a sudden you see all this very strong influence on the disk. You see these ridges. These are areas where there is a huge, essentially, discontinuity or a huge gradient of the field. This is something we're going to have to be careful with in the numerical implementation. The black hole begins to accrete some of that matter, and I mean, there's all sort of things. in particular, these higher density regions becomes hotter. If they are hotter, they can induce themselves some interesting electromagnetic emissions in there. And these are some pictures that if you were an advanced civilization with a good enough telescope that is looking at this system at some distance away, these are the pictures you would be taking at different at a particular frequency coming from this disk at different angles, etc. This is the other possibility where we now think, well, suppose this disk is threading some magnetic fields through the black holes. As the black holes are around, begin to twist the fields in a significant way. We'll talk about that in next week. And then you can ask, well, is there a net pointing flux resulting from the fact that these objects are steering the fields? Let me just show this one. And then, okay, this is showing the net pointing flux that the system is producing due to this black holes going around and steering the fields around. That's as far as just what binary black holes may do with to surrounding stress energy that may be there because of electromagnetic fields or by or through matter. But is it another interesting, very interesting system is a black hole near a star. This is one of the main candidates for trying to explain the short gamma ray bursts. This amazingly energetic events that happens. I mean, everywhere, and when they go on, they completely outshine the rest of the universe combined. So it's very difficult to explain that much energy in that short a time without invoking a black hole playing a very major role. So again, there is a lot of work here. The problem is by no means done, but it's just an example of, say, a star that is interacting with a black hole. The black hole spins. As the star gets sufficiently close, tidal effects significantly begin to affect the star. It begins to strip out the outer layers of the star till it essentially shreds it apart and forms with it an accretion disk. Eventually, there is a big question on how this accretion disk can interact with the black hole, and this is one of the areas that Scott works on. You can also ask what the gravitational waves are, but this we'll discuss next week. And these are some snapshots of how, for a given density, you do isopicnic. That's a fancy name. So isocontours of the isodensity contours. And this is how we sum of this the behavior as the star is shredded. I'll tell you next week why this looks like a square and things like that. Same thing with a neutron star. A binary neutron star is the other leading candidate to explain short gamma ray bursts. And here you just see, I zoom in at the equatorial plane of two stars that are going to each other. And you can see these kind of boxes are moving around. These are higher or more finely refined boxes that are put in there so that you are able to do things with respect to. You're able to discretize that particular region with a much finer grid so as to capture the finer physics that is going on in the system at that given time. And this is also a technique called adaptive mesh refinement that we'll discuss next week. So now I'm going to just kind of hand the baton to Scott. Let me just introduce this Scott Noble. He, just a few words about him. He got his PhD with Matt Choptwick in UTexas/UBC, so he was traveling back and forth. There we met and we worked at UBC together for a while. He then moved to the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, and that's when he started getting very serious with disks and things like that. Then John Hopkins University with John Krolik, one of the fathers of the field, and he's now a research associate or something like that, right? Research something at Rochester Institute of Technology, so he's not that too far. And he's one of the leading experts in disks, accretion disks, and he's involved very heavily in a very interesting project that maybe he can tell at some point of trying to image the event horizon around that is defined by the black hole in the center of our galaxy. There is a very exciting possibility there. Then now the detectors are getting accurate enough that you can resolve small enough scales to be able to tell whether there is an event horizon or not there. So anyways. And yes?
I have a short question about the gamma ray.
Yes.
There was a paper released on that stuff just like 4 days ago.
Uh-huh.
And the, I guess it seems like the title is kind of high, the missing link.
Yeah. Let's see. I can turn off the microphone and we can talk about this later.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, so please call me Scott. Only my wife calls me Dr. Coble. So. Okay. So, I primarily do accretion disk simulations. My PhD thesis was on critical phenomenon of collapsing neutron stars, which you know is much more glamorous and popular than accretion disks. But I chose to go astray and into the astrophysics community. So, but now it's exciting because the accretion disk phenomenon is, even though it's been typically just in the astrophysics community, the relativity community is being more interested in it too because of supermassive black holes. As Louis said, are involved in galaxy mergers, and there's lots of gas in these galaxy mergers. And so possibly we can see actual electromagnetic emissions from these black hole supermassive black hole mergers. And recently, unfortunately, LISA has stopped being funded by NASA. So searching for these objects in the electromagnetic band may be our only hope for actually observing the supermassive binary mergers. So here, though, we only have one black hole. The event horizon is indicated by this white line. And so what you usually do is you set up a time-independent space-time. This guy's not spinning. This black hole is not spinning. It's Schwarzschild. And you stick some material, usually in hydrostatic equilibrium, so that you know that there are no transients going that are going to start right away. And then you thread with magnetic field, and that makes it unstable. So the magnetic field then generates some torques and allows for material to fall in as it acts as an angular momentum transfer agent. And so the disk becomes quickly turbulent. Do I hit enter? No. So it quickly goes unstable, it becomes highly turbulent, and unfortunately, even though these involve time-independent space-times, they're very complicated because you have to run them for a very long time. So typical numerical relativity simulations where you have to solve Einstein's equations last only for maybe a couple thousand m being the total mass of the system. But here, in order to get into a steady state in the disk, you have to run at least for 10,000 m, or if not larger, to get a good statistically valid steady state. So meaning that your accretion rate over the span of your simulation is constant, and various quantities are do not exhibit large secular trends, for instance. So it doesn't exhibit wild behavior or large, like, uniform trend in one direction. So because we expect that these systems do follow steady states because we see these disks and they are steady for large periods of time. Even though they do change behaviors for the physical time that we are simulating for, they're relatively quiet. So down, right. And so what we do is also, because we know the space-time for all time, we can send photons So this is the magnetic field. So the white contours are the magnetic field lines. And so you can see how the magnetic field acts to churn up the fluid as it accretes. And also, as the magnetic field accretes, the black hole, if it was spinning, would spin up the torque up the magnetic field and lead to a jet. But in this case, it's not. So it's just kind of being these contours are it's really a visualization artifact. So there is some magnetic field, but it's very small. So this is a black hole around a spinning black hole. This is a disk around a spinning black hole, and what we've done is we've ray traced the essentially the dissipation in the gas, which so when a fluid dissipates, it heats up, and then that heat is turned into light, and that light then reaches the observer, and we can look at spectra, we can look at variability. And so this is a model of this light from the corona, or the hot part of the disk that's above the bulk of the disk. And so you can see the strong curvature effects of the black hole. You can see this Einstein ring where a lot of the light rays are focused about the black hole and form this ring. And you can't see the backside of the disk because we've included some opacity in this model. And this is a so we've taken a this was supposed to be another different movie, but do you have the I saw you did have the movie in the window, but. I noticed it when you were showing me the slides, but we got. Yeah, it doesn't look too different. We can continue on. Yeah. So anyway, so if you wanna, I can show you the movie later. But it's of this. Accretion flow around the supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy. It's called the black hole is called Sagittarius A star. It's a bright radio source, and in wavelengths above 10 to the 12 hertz, the flow becomes optically thin, and you can actually see the plasma dynamics all the way to the horizon. And since it's the largest black hole on our sky, you know, it's 4 million solar masses big, and it's only 8 kiloparsecs away. Even though there are maybe there are galactic black holes closer, they're much smaller. They're a million times smaller. So, so this one is really big and relatively close, and so it actually, in area, takes up more part of the sky than any other black hole. And so, it serves as a prime candidate in visualizing what happens in the immediate vicinity of a black hole, and so possibly we could use it as probes of strong gravity. We could do GR tests. So that's why it's particularly an exciting source. So that concludes our motivational speech, and I guess now we're going to go into the nitty-gritty of class. So I believe Luis started out, I don't know, you can't see this part, right? Thank you. So Luis, stop me if I'm wrong, introduced the advection equation. And so this is a 1D advection equation, assuming A is a real number. And in practice, we can take, we'll have actually a system of equations. So this will be a matrix, and Q will be a vector. And actually, we would also have other dimensions that we can propagate the field in. And in general, we're actually going to be concerned with equations of this form. So this will be 1, B2, etc. And this will be equal to some source of Q. And the xi's and t. So xi being part of typical coordinates. So equations of this form are called conservation equations. Typically, if you forget S, so you just have this principal part, then it's a conservation law. So you have some flux. So these are fluxes. So you can imagine fluxes passing through a volume. So if we're in Z, y, x space. So flux out of this surface would be this F1 flux. Okay. And we would have a conserved quantity Q whose volume integral is conserved assuming that there's no flux. Okay, so if the gradient of the flux through the volume is zero, then the amount of Q remains constant, Q comma T is zero. But if there is, then that means that, so if there is flux, then portions of Q get moved around to other adjacent cubes. And so how much flux goes through this surface enters the next cube, etc. So we're essentially in these conservation laws. They're called conservation laws because we're just moving around stuff. That stuff is conserved. It just doesn't magically appear or disintegrate. The sources change that picture slightly, but really it's the principal part of the conservation laws. It has a lot of mathematical history and background, and we can exploit that background because of the principal part of these equations. The sources don't involve derivatives of Q, and so don't change the principal part of our equations. What it does is it changes maybe how Q is defined in different portions of space. So for instance, if you look at the fluid equations in a curved space-time, energy, as observed from infinity, changes when you go deeper into the potential. Okay, so that's why there's a source term on the right-hand side. So these are the types of equations. So just as a side note, they're called hyperbolic if this matrix is diagonalizable and has real eigenvalues, and those real eigenvalues are not degenerate. Okay, so we'll be only looking at those cases in this course, and we'll actually only be looking at the 1D version of that equation. But I wanted to point out that it's easily generalizable to more spatial dimensions and more than one equation. Actually, we'll be looking at a series of equations, not just one-dimensional equation. So Yes. So, okay. So, again, conservation laws. Why? So, let's give an example. So, let me start. I don't know. M is equal to. So, we consider a line, let's say. And there's some density that lives on that line. Can you see? We go from x1 to x2. So the integral of that density, be a linear density in this case, would be the mass in that on that line. Okay. So these are, let's consider these to be walls, and that there's some flow. So consider this as a gas. So there's some flow in this direction. So there's some flow at each face. So the change in mass is just the amount of density times this velocity at this face minus that of this face. Okay, so it's a rate of mass flow out of that segment. Okay, so what we want, though, so what we see is that also, so by the first law of calculus, you notice that this part is really the derivative of this integral. Okay, so we've essentially, so we can take, so this is equal to this, so we bring this on the right-hand side and we set to zero, and we've got this equation. Okay, so before we do that, sorry. We'll assume that the fields are relatively smooth, that they don't have discontinuities. So we can bring this derivative inside, okay, and we can bring this derivative inside. But in general, that's not necessarily the case, okay? So because we could develop discontinuities, we'll see that later. And so we bring everything under the same integral. And we differentiate, we also integrate over time. And so we're led to this final system, this final equation. And that is equal to zero. So we've turned the integral equations into a differential equation. So if the integrand is zero, then the integral is zero. So we typically just look at this differential equation as our conservation law, even though it originates physically from integral equations. Okay, so the integral equations are really the fundamental form of the conservation law. But in practice, we typically look at the PDEs. We'll see that the integral form allows us to solve some of the difficulties that arises when we try to solve the PDE in practice. So as an example, let's consider this Berger's equation. So we've got, as as Luis described. So if we have the advection equation, A is constant. Okay, so if you have a disturbance, Qx, that looks something like this in space, it'll just move to the right at velocity A. Okay, so at some later time, so if this is t equals 0, some later time, you've got Q here, and it's moved, you know, like that. And any changes in shape are due to my artistic inability, so. But if we have, so this is Berger's equation. Or it also can be written in this form. Where f of q is equal to q squared over 2. So this is a spatial derivative of this flux q. But let's look at it in this form first. And now, though, our speed is no longer a constant, right? Because if you look at q here, the speed is, you know, some constant value here, or 0. For simplicity, let's mark this as the 0 point. So it increases up to its peak here, and then it diminishes again. So if you were to, so different parts then are going to be moving faster and slower than other parts. Okay, so there's going to be some smearing going on. And so let's look at how this thing would evolve. So we take this shape again. Okay, so this is the qx plane. And let's look at its characteristics. So I'm just going to kind of mark off the background, the silhouette of it in the qx plane. So dash is qx, but this is really going to be the tx plane. It's a space-time diagram of the characteristics of the solution. In relativity, it's a space-time diagram. In mathematics or fluid dynamics, it's a characteristic plot of the characteristics. So here, it's going the fastest, okay? So let's say it's going, so nothing can go faster than the speed of light, which is this line, let's say, okay? So it's going at some fairly fast speed here. But here, it's going at a slower speed. Here, an even slower speed. Here, it's going at a slower speed, so it just goes like that. Okay, so here, if we drew those diagrams, we would see that they would all propagate like this. Okay, so we could, so these lines map out where the solution evolves to. So if this is a value of q, q naught, for instance, this region of space, about within this little element, will always be q naught. Okay, so it's q naught in here. So that's how this solution propagates in time. Okay, so this is. So the characteristics that I'm drawing are in the tx plane here. So essentially, the characteristics mark off boundaries of changes in value states. Okay. So q is different over here than it is in here. However, we see that these characteristics overlap and converge at this point. Essentially means that the function becomes multi-valued. But if we think of Q as a density, for instance, Q can't become keyword, the density can't be multi-valued. Gas cannot have three different values of the density at any one point. It has one value of the density. So something, we know from our physical gut that something must change. And so, well, what happens? So if you actually evolve this equation, you see that Q of X becomes steeper and steeper until it becomes a shock or a discontinuity. So a shock is technically just, in gas dynamics, it's where the pressure becomes discontinuous. If the density is, there are other discontinuities that aren't shocks, those are called maybe contact discontinuities where the density changes but not the pressure. In any case, I'll probably call these shocks even though sometimes they're contact discontinuities, but for the sake of our sake of discussion, any discontinuity is a shock. So here we see that this Gaussian kind of it keeps on steepening into a very sharp feature. And the hydrodynamics or this conservation law equation essentially breaks down because it's essentially the characteristic or the causal structure kind of breaks down. And we need alternative ways of solving this problem. One way you could address this is by solving the viscous form of the equations. So you take, for instance, QT plus QX is equal to epsilon Q double X. So that's a second spatial derivative. So this acts as a viscous or dissipative term in the equations. So if epsilon is really, really large, then it's going to be very inflexible, essentially. Okay. So, and you won't get very steep peaks or steep gradients. But if it's very small, then essentially the equation doesn't change. Okay. If epsilon is 10 to the minus 10 relative to Q, then you're going to get essentially the same dynamics. So you'll still get the steepening up until a point in which the double derivative of Q becomes large at that discontinuity. And then it starts dissipating that shock. Okay? And so what we hope is that as we turn epsilon up, that our solution, that we solve this equation some other way, matches this limit solution. Okay, so this is called the entropy solution of the problem, that this is the inviscid limit of the equations. So we hope that our numerical algorithm, however, whatever it is, satisfies this inviscid limit. Okay, because we kind of assume that nature, we know nature is viscous, okay, but most of our problems in astrophysics that we're interested in the relativistic limit, neutron stars are not very viscous, but they are finite, they have finite viscosity, so we know that there is some viscosity. But as people who actually want to solve problems, we have to do find practical solutions, ways to simulate these objects, and so we take the inviscid limit perfectly. But in nature, it's not perfectly satisfied. So what I'm trying to say is that the solutions that we present as our model need to satisfy this inviscid limit, because that's the anticipated limit that we're taking. And so one way of doing that limit or finding those entropy solutions is through this methodology, the entropy solutions are also called weak solutions, and they satisfy this equation. So we take some function phi, and we kind of slap it onto the conservation equation. OK? Okay. This is a fairly common analysis trick. So phi has compact support, meaning it's only non-zero in a finite region of space. And we exploit Gauss's law, and we take partial, we integrate this by parts, and we find that if there's a weak solution to be found, then this equation should be satisfied. So we expect to find several types of weak solutions, several different weak solutions that satisfy these this boundary condition, essentially. So we need a weak solution exists if this is satisfied, and if any function phi of compact support can be used. Okay, so if there's a weak solution, then it should, to some extent, satisfy the entropy condition, which is a condition that can be defined mathematically, but in practice, it means that the second law of thermodynamics is satisfied. Entropy isn't decreasing; that's being preserved, and we choose the weak solution to satisfy that entropy condition. Okay, so there's a spectrum of weak solutions. We choose the one that is entropy conserving and satisfies the inviscid limit. Okay, and so we'll be talking about numerical algorithms that hope to do this. And it's not very clear in the presentation of these numerical algorithms how they do that. But I encourage you, if you're interested, to read about it. I recommend this book, very good book. It's expensive, but it's very nice. It goes into a little bit of the mathematical background of conservation law theory. So, we're doing this to solve problems. We're not doing this because we're mathematical physicists necessarily. So at least I think the aim of this course is to actually get some practical knowledge. And so we just want to maybe learn the numerical algorithm to have some understanding of it, but not all the details of it. So we'll be learning how to solve these equations on a computer. So the algorithm themselves are very complicated. So if we were to do all of the background and the algorithm investigation, then it would be too much to cover. So, the solution method that is exploited is this Godunov scheme. Okay, so we assume that we have these finite volumes. Yeah, that we're solving the equations with. Okay, so they said that there's some conserved quantity, and it resides in this little discrete volume. Okay, and so in the numerical jargon, it's finite volume. Okay, so it's a finite volume method. And what instead of taking derivatives of continuum fields, we take differences of volume integrals. Okay, so So we have flux x, flux y, flux z, that direction. Or, I'm sorry, I defined them this way, didn't I? And recalling that we had integral forms of the conservation laws, we know that, so taking the volume average of our conservation law, over this volume, so we can break down, we can bring this volume integral into the, so this is the continuum equation. We're integrating over the volume space. This is over our delta V. And also our, so I'm assuming this V is a space-time volume, okay? So we're taking the space-time volume, so you know it would be a four-dimensional integral if we were doing this in three spatial dimensions in one time, but let's restrict to the 1D spatial problem. And so you can see, I'll let you prove that you can turn this into an equation of differences where you have now, so I'm sorry, I'll erase this vector because we're not talking about, we're restricting to the 1D problem. So if we define Q bar as the volume integral of Q, our conserved quantity, then we can show that this equation takes this form. Q bar Qn plus 1 minus Q bar n over dt is equal to 1 over dx . So we've essentially, this is just the first law of calculus, essentially. So we've taken limits from the, so in space we take the right and left edges of the box as our limits, and in time some tn to tn plus 1 in space-time, and some xi plus xi to some xi plus 1 in space. Okay, so the I index refers to the spatial location. So here in this volume, we would have xi plus 1 and xi. Okay, and if we have, so let me draw the space-time part. So this is t, this is x. We have xi, xi plus 1. We have t, tn, and tn plus 1. So these fluxes represent now a time average of the flux out of this surface. So that's why it's capital F, it's not lowercase f. So capital F is the time average of the flux out of the surface. Q is the volume integral, the spatial volume integral. I'm sorry. So it should be, in this case, I meant 1 over dx. I think I was using x2 too, so I'm sorry. So x to x, x sub I to x sub I plus 1 of q dx. So the rate of change of q is just the time integral of the flux through that surface over a period of time dt. Okay. So if you imagine our system, so our system is okay, so should we maybe end? So I guess we're...
I'll say a few things to wrap it up.
Okay. So Luis introduced finite difference equations last week, and so where you break down your domain into a series of points, you solve the solution on those points, and you have your simulation or your result. Here we're going to break down our domain into volumes. We're going to treat the grid functions as volume averages over those little cells, and then we're going to solve for how those volume averages evolve in time. And so instead of a continuum function, it's going to be this approximation of a finite average, a finite volume integral of a quantity over a domain. So I guess we'll, oh yeah, so. Yeah. Yes, you're right. Yeah, I made a mistake there. I introduced the space-time V here, and then I used V here, but yeah, there.
Yeah, and then this one comes. The reason we need to switch gears and introduce all these extra new quantity is what Scott mentioned. Here, this equation will routinely be priced with these continuity for shots. It only makes sense to understand that from a volume point of view, that you'd say, okay, I got so much energy in this box, and it's going to change because something leaves that box or comes into the box. We'll have to kind of come up with a new way of thinking the problem when you're really dealing with this kind of question. That, in addition to what we said here, last week, well, more refined because we need better accuracy, etc., gives you two different ways, two different set of techniques to think in two different formulas of equations that one typically deals with in this box. So either it was a generate shots or not, those are the two families of hyperbolic problems we're going to
do. Right. And the reason why we get shocks is essentially because we brought those derivatives inside the integrals and we assumed that things were smooth. If we kept them out and we were differencing the integrals, then we'd be fine. And that's why we're doing it this way. We're kind of taking the partial derivatives outside the integrals, and then we're going to difference the integrals themselves. And so that way we can better accommodate the conservation equations.
So yes, the tutorial today will be at 1:45 or so, as usual. And also, there is the homework that requires only pencil and paper on the analytical work. So this homework can be done instead of the second numerical problems.
So you've got three numerical labs, of which you can choose two. Or you can choose one and then whichever one you want on this one. The second part of this